I mean that Kew Gardens is the first place in Europe where kangaroos were found after they were brought back from Australia. We have the bones to prove it, and we also in the Royal Archive have correspondence from George III saying to his courtiers, "Would you please accept a kangaroo for your estate, sir?" And they reply, "No, sire, we have no fences high enough to contain them." But perhaps the more interesting thing from an Australian context is that at least a part of the Australian sheep industry had its origin in Kew, because in 1810, Sir Joseph Banks was ordered by George III, during one of his bouts of madness, to auction off his livestock, including merino sheep that had been acquired from Spain, probably under rather dubious circumstances, for the king. And these were then auctioned off around the pagoda. So there is a curious connection between the pagoda and the Australian sheep industry, because the man who bought the merinos exported them to Australia as part of founding that industry. You didn't know that, did you?
I absolutely did not know that. But what happened to the bones of the kangaroos and the kangaroos themselves? Do we know?
I don't know if we know what happened to the kangaroos ultimately, but they were breeding so successfully, they had to be removed. They were becoming a liability. When we celebrated Kew's heritage recently in 2006, we actually had some wallabies in the same area of the gardens around the Queen's Cottage grounds as a reminder of this important fact. But of course, wallabies, as you know, don't jump as high as kangaroos, so they were a little easier to contain.
Nigel Taylor, curator at Kew Gardens in London, one of the truly great centres of scientific botany. And they're in the process of organising their 250th birthday party, which may include a mob of roos, but may also feature those very sexy plants, the orchids. Nigel Taylor is also Kew's historian, and history is seen all over through his window.
Well, the biggest thing you can see out of my window across the Palmhouse Pond is, of course, Kew's Palmhouse, which was opened in 1848 and is a remarkable structure made from cast and wrought iron, which was majorly restored about 20 years ago. But the palm house was the way the Victorians could see tropical vegetation. They couldn't get into a 747 and get out at the other end in the tropics. They had to imagine what it was like, and they got a pretty good idea from the plants growing in the glasshouse.
It is huge, isn't it? When they first set it up, did they have to experiment to see how it would work, establishing a hothouse like that?
It was an experiment. The man who designed it was the architect Decimus Burton, but the man who really should get the credit for the structure is a guy called Richard Turner, who was a ship's foundryman from Dublin. And if you look at the structure and you turn it upside down, what do you have but the hull of a ship? So he adapted the technology he'd been developing in shipbuilding and converted it into a glasshouse.
Gosh, I can see just what you mean with that lovely curved centrepiece as well and that vast door. It's a huge door, isn't it, right in the middle?
Yes, a vast door to bring in vast plants, if necessary, and that's exactly what they did.
Going further back, when was the Kew Gardens actually established? Not necessarily as a botanical gardens, but something else.
Well, the history of Kew in the full begins in 1718, when the future George II leased the western half of the estate and was then succeeded in around 1730 by his son, Frederick, who leased the eastern half of the estate. And in fact, we still have a roadway going through the estate which marks the boundary between these two royal gardens. And the interesting thing about this relationship is that the Georgians hated their firstborn sons, the ones who were set to become the next king. And indeed, this was the case with George II and his son Frederick. They hated each other, even to the extent that Frederick's mother refused to see him on her deathbed. She hated him. Yet he occupied the site immediately adjacent to their estate. Why did he do that? That's an interesting question.
Any ideas?
I suspect rivalry. If we were kind, we would say it was to do with trying to make friends with his parents, but I don't think that was really his interest. He wanted to show off that he could make a better garden than they could.
Talk about gardens. Is this the oldest in England?
No. Kew is very far from being the oldest garden of any kind in England, certainly not the oldest botanic garden. Our botanic gardens go back to the 17th century. Kew's origin is in the 18th century. But it is the most important, and arguably the most important in the world.
So the older ones, would they include Oxford?
Oxford and the Chelsea Physic Garden in London. These are the two oldest. They go back to the first half of the 17th century.
When was Kew established as the Royal Botanic Gardens with that kind of scientific role?
It became a scientific institution in 1841 when it was transferred from the Royal Estates to be a government-funded institution, and its role from there on was largely scientific. However, as a botanic garden, it started in 1759 when the first head gardener in charge of the botanical collections was appointed by Princess Augusta, the father of George III. The mother, I beg your pardon, of George III.
And that's the anniversary we're looking forward to at the moment.
That's right. Next year, 2009, is 250 years since 1759. And many of us feel that this institution has another 250 years at least in front of it, and we're planning for that next 250.
And you're the historian, are you? Do you look at the broad thrust of these various influences with royalty and scientists and collectors and whatever?
I'm not a professional historian, but I've become a kind of historian because of my current role as curator, because we are steeped in history here, and understanding Kew's history is a very good way of understanding where it has to go in the future. The two are inextricably linked.
So what's the essence of the role that was established 250 years ago? What made it the great institution we all know in most countries with an interest in plants?
It was all about collecting things that were going to be useful. The great British Empire was at its zenith, and even the countries that weren't painted pink on the map held plants of tremendous value. So things like rubber came from Brazil and was distributed to British colonies, where it made a fortune for the plantation owners.
It was stolen, wasn't it?
The popular interpretation today is that it was stolen, but I think that's viewing the thing with modern eyes. I'm not sure it would have been regarded as theft in those days. In those days, countries didn't own their plants in the way that they do nowadays under the Convention on Biological Diversity.
But this was a great sorting house to see what was important, to see how it should be studied and classified. So it really was there at the beginning.
It was. The initial driver was economic botany. And in fact, the building we're speaking in is the world's first museum of economic botany, established in 1857. But if you wish to understand the economic uses of plants, you first have to know what they are. And so very quickly, Kew became a centre for the identification of plants. And we have these huge collections, preserved collections of dried plants in the herbarium, representing virtually every known plant on the planet. That's the powerhouse that drives Kew, the identification skills that we have.
Where did the expertise come from at that time, those centuries ago, when you obviously needed people who could recognise plants, not just ones that they'd seen before, but ones from the other side of the planet?
Well, in the earliest days, the plant knowledge was vested, I think, in the gardening staff, because there weren't really scientists on site. But from 1841, with the appointment of Sir William Hooker, the first director, Kew had a scientific mind directing it. In fact, all subsequent directors have been scientists also, nearly all of them plant taxonomists, people who understand plant diversity. And the collections that I mentioned before, these are the reference collections that you use to identify things. And very quickly, a scientific staff developed, and they developed specialisms in different parts of the world or in different groups of plants. You know, botanists can either know a flora, like the flora of Australia, for example, that would be quite a big challenge, or they may know a family very well. As a botanist, I'm an expert on the cactus family. A family, by the way, which is not very popular in Australia because of the problems it causes when they escape.
Prickly pear, yes, indeed. But cactus from America, they're not indigenous in many other places, are they?
Look, this explains one thing about the British and their interest in plants. We have a very depauperate native flora. It's about 1,500 species. Some would argue a few more, but not much more than that. Therefore, we have a huge interest in what other people have got. So the fact that cacti are only found in the Americas naturally, or nearly all, come from there, is of no consequence. We want to study them. They're interesting. They're exotic. And so we want to know more about them. And that's what I've devoted my life to.
Yes. It's amazing how leisurely that process can be. I remember when you talk about the Australian material, when Banks brought it back, it took him something like a century to publish the damn stuff, didn't it?
Botany of this sort has been quite slow because the accumulation of knowledge that you need to make a good flora is a slow process. It's even harder today in a way because we've got much more specimens to look at. In the days of the Hookers, father and son, who became the first two directors, they didn't have many specimens of each species, so it was quite easy to work out what the differences were. But when you have lots and lots of specimens and they're variable, it's harder to perceive immediately how you distinguish two things or three or four things. And so this kind of botany is slow. Of course, with modern molecular techniques, we're starting to penetrate into the innards of the plant in a way which you could never do before. And you can distinguish individuals now. That's becoming relatively easy. But most plant identification is still today done by visual examination, sometimes with a microscope or a hand lens, but basically macro visualization of the plant. And then recalling from your data bank in your grey matter, have I seen this before? What does this remind me of? Which family could this belong to? And so on.
Reminds me, the present director, coming from Western Australia, that's actually where you've got a hot spot. In other words, zillions of species, immense biodiversity. And I suppose that sort of experience has stood him in good stead here.
Yes, it certainly has. And in fact, Kew's work as a whole is about discovering and identifying hotspots and drawing attention to their importance. Because the hotspots of the world do contain a very considerable proportion of the world's total biodiversity, whether it be plants, animals, fungi, bacteria, whatever. They're concentrated in certain precious places, and these are the ones that more than anywhere else we need to preserve.
Okay, so 250th anniversary coming up in that busy year 2009. How are you going to celebrate it here, with a gigantic exhibition of cacti?
I would personally love to have a gigantic exhibition of cacti, but being more realistic, what we're going to do is to have extravagant horticultural displays at our two principal gates of entry. That's the main gate and the Victoria Gate. Both of these major entry points for visitors, and we have about 1.5 million a year, are very understated in horticultural terms, and we want to make more of them, especially for the 250th year, a year when we hope the Queen will probably visit us, when we'll have many other parties and celebrations. And it's Kew's horticulture, in my eyes, that is the most important thing for the public to see. And so we want to make a big splash this coming year.
And so if people want to come from Australia, what will they see when they walk in the gates?
Well, if they come in early spring, they will see a spectacular of flowering bulbs, millions of flowering bulbs. If they come later in the year, into summer, they will see herbaceous plants from every continent on the planet, making a spectacularly colourful display. So if you think of a continent, we will have some plants from it. And we will also have a world map identifying where Kew works in the world, which is more than 50 countries.
Nigel Taylor, curator at Kew Gardens. You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.